ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, welcome to The World Today. It's Tuesday, the 28th of October. I'm Andy Park, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. Today, King Charles publicly heckled over Epstein allegations surrounding his brother, Prince Andrew. And time to buy a lottery ticket. A car driving in country South Australia struck through the windscreen by a possible meteorite.
There was this huge explosion. I mean, it was extremely violent. The next thing I remember is that I'm in the seat and I'm covered in glass. My wife's going, the car's blown up. I thought, oh, we've had an accident. And then I sort of looked at the screen and went, oh, no, the car's still driving. And it was just happily driving up the highway.
The peak body representing childcare centres has called for tighter regulations around who can open private facilities. The call follows chilling revelations in last night's Four Corners program that pedophiles are using encrypted forums to swap tactics and advice about access to centres. It's come as the federal government mulls its response. The opposition has welcomed bipartisan measures to help stamp out the issue. Here's Oliver Gordon.
Early Childhood Australia Chief Executive Samantha Page says last night's Four Corners was devastating.
The organised nature of sexual abuse predators confirms what a lot of us have been feeling, and that is that while we have always been committed to child safety and safeguarding, we need to ramp those efforts right up.
The ABC program revealed pedophiles have infiltrated the country's childcare industry by exploiting regulations and staffing inadequacies. It also showed predators are using the dark web to share information about how to gain access to childcare centres. In response, Ms. Page is calling on the federal government to overhaul the national regulatory framework, strengthen quality standards, and require those who run centres to show they're committed to child safety, not just profits.
These are the steps that we need to take now to ensure that families can be confident and to be sure that children are safe in every setting across the country.
For-profit providers are overrepresented in the child abuse and neglect statistics in early childcare. Why do you think this is?
I think that is because they're more likely to look for cost savings on staffing, and so more likely to run at minimum staff ratios. Good quality providers do not rely on minimum staffing ratios, and I don't think the staffing ratios have served us well as a profession. We need to move beyond that, and we need to be saying, what does safe staffing look like? Either change the ratios or add to the ratios.
Last year, following allegations, Victorian man Joshua Dale Brown assaulted 8 children and produced child abuse material, the federal government introduced legislation giving the Commonwealth power to cut off funding to childcare centres that don't meet the national quality standard. The legislation also allows officers to perform spot checks without warning to detect fraud and non-compliance. Labor frontbencher Don Farrell has responded to last night's Four Corners.
The government is obviously very concerned about these developments and what's been disclosed on Four Corners. We'll have more to say about that issue as the days and the weeks are ahead.
Shadow Early Learning Minister Julian Lisa described last night's episode as one of the most chilling things he's seen on television, and says the opposition is willing to offer bipartisan support to protect children.
We need to ensure that we're giving law enforcement adequate tools. We need to ensure that the childcare regulators have the tools that they need as well. And that's why I've written again to the Minister this morning to offer our support.
National Children's Commissioner Anne Hollands has renewed her calls for the issue to be discussed at Cabinet by appointing a new Minister for Child Safety.
You know, there's good reasons why we have a Cabinet Minister, a senior Cabinet Minister for Women in Katie Gallagher. Women's safety is a priority at National Cabinet. Child safety is not a priority.
Early Childhood Australia Chief Executive Samantha Page has encouraged nervous parents to spend time talking with early childhood educators.
Observe, are they calm and confident in the work that they're doing? Do children look happy and relaxed and engaged in rich learning experiences? How stable is the team? Ask them, how long have you worked here?
And she says with the spotlight on the early learning sector, it will likely be a tense day.
The level of anxiety amongst families that they're going to be responding to, the level of grief that they're going to have in their team of educators who are rocked and devastated by the revelations on Four Corners, those service leaders need our support right now more than ever.
Sam Page from the Early Childhood Australia organisation, ending that report by Oliver Gordon. And if you've experienced childhood trauma or abuse, you can call the Blue Knot helpline on 1300 657 380. US President Donald Trump is continuing his whirlwind trip through Asia. Today he's in Japan, the US's most important strategic ally in the region. Japan's new Prime Minister, Sanae Takeuchi, will be aiming to build a good relationship with Mr. Trump, and it already looks like it's off to a good start. Here's Donald Trump speaking earlier.
This will be a relationship that will be stronger than ever before, and I look forward to working with you. And on behalf of our country, I want to just let you know, anytime you have any question, any doubt, anything you want, any favors you need, anything I can do to help Japan, we will be there. We are an ally at the strongest level.
For more, here's Nicole Johnston.
President Trump likes a royal welcome, and Japan didn't disappoint. After touching down yesterday, he met Japanese Emperor Naruhito at the Imperial Palace. It went well.
Wait a minute.
But in true Trump style, he made most of his comments on the flight to Japan from Malaysia on Air Force One. On North Korea, Mr. Trump said he'd like another opportunity to meet its supreme leader.
I haven't mentioned it. I haven't said anything, but I'd love to meet with him if he'd like to meet. I got along great with Kim Jong-un.
Donald Trump also again talked about a third term in office. Under the US Constitution, the maximum is two terms.
Am I not ruling it out? You'll have to tell me. All I can tell you is that we have a great group of people, which they don't.
And while today is all about Japan, Mr. Trump has his eyes on the prize. Thursday's meeting with China's leader Xi Jinping, the first sit-down they've had since the US election.
I have a lot of respect for President Xi, and we're going to come away with a deal.
Former US ambassador to China, Nicholas Burns, says this trade deal will likely cover TikTok, fentanyl, agriculture and critical minerals.
Neither leader can end up as a loser, certainly politically. I think that's been quite obvious on the Chinese side. The Chinese have met each U.S. move blow for blow, punch for punch, and the same is true of the U.S.
And in Japan and China, one of the big questions is, how much support would Mr. Trump give Taiwan if China invaded the self-governed island? Rana Mitter is ST Lee Chair at the Harvard Kennedy School.
The Japanese, particularly under their new Prime Minister Takeuchi, are going to be concerned about whether or not Asia-Pacific security guarantees continue. But I think Taiwan is really going to be where the rubber hits the road. And it'll be interesting to see whether or not Xi and Trump actually address that issue openly at all.
For Japan, there's a lot at stake. This will be the first time its new Prime Minister, Sanae Takeuchi, meets Mr. Trump. Japan is a critical part of the US strategy for containing China inside what is known as the First Island Chain that stretches from South Korea to Japan, Taiwan, and down to the Philippines. Mira Raphooper is an Asia expert at the Brookings Institute. She's speaking here to the BBC.
There's no more important ally to the United States in the Asia-Pacific region than Japan. We, of course, have nearly 50,000 troops stationed in the country, and Japan is a partner on pretty much everything we do throughout Asia. And I think that Prime Minister Takeuchi has well calculated that she has an opportunity to really appeal to President Trump and help him understand how much Japan has to offer.
And it's offering trade to buy American soybeans, liquefied natural gas, and trucks. The Nikkei newspaper has reported that Ms. Takeuchi may arrange Ford Chevy trucks out on the streets so Mr. Trump can see them. That would put a smile on his face. But this won't. Around 100 protesters took to Tokyo's streets.
I've never been a fan of Trump's casual discriminatory remarks, his sexist comments, and his rhetoric against immigrants.
Prime Minister Anthony Albanese is also in Asia. He's in Malaysia at the summit of ASEAN, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations.
Nicole Johnston there. Thanks for listening to The World Today on ABC Radio across Australia and on the Listen app. You can subscribe to the podcast for all of our stories. Just search for The World Today. A senior manager working in Australia's fractured aged care sector has spoken out about the problems still plaguing the industry. The mental health crisis impacting older Australians is worsening, and with no mandate to come out of the Royal Commission in relation to mental health, staff feel like they've been left to implement their own strategies. Melbourne researchers have now designed a world-first guide for all workers in aged care to help them better manage the mental health of residents without the need for medication. Here's Kathleen O'Connor.
4 years since the Royal Commission handed down its recommendations, aged care worker Amanda says the sector is still plagued with the same issues.
Lack of education. We don't have full-time workers anymore. Time frame is very limited and the resources are very limited too.
Amanda is the manager of an aged care facility in Brisbane and doesn't want to use her real name. She's worked in the sector for 15 years and says since the Royal Commission into aged care, there's been a concerning rise in mental health issues among some of her residents.
There is a mainstream focus on the nursing care minutes, but there is still no attention given to that psychosocial well-being side yet. Most nursing homes have one or two lifestyle staff member or activity staff member, but that's not enough at all.
Amanda says over a third of the 100 residents she manages need extra care with their mental health. Many are on medication.
Most of them are actually lonely, and a lot of the time there is a relationship between the parent and the children, but the relationship is not deep enough for the child to understand that there are mental health concerns there.
Recommendation 38 of the Royal Commission into Aged Care Quality and Safety suggests providers employ allied health professionals, including a mental health practitioner. It was never mandated, but Amanda saw the need. A year ago, she began training her own wellness nurses to help tackle the problem. She says it's a daily struggle.
And we constantly spend the time with them, but I don't get any funding to have that specialised care for that particular person. Like, we have to utilise what we have to, give that support to the residents.
According to the Australian and New Zealand Journal of Psychiatry, almost 60% of aged care residents have at least one mental health condition. Professor Sue Neil Barr is the director of the Swinburne Wellbeing Clinic for Older Adults and was an expert witness in the 2018 Royal Commission. He says it's often difficult for aged care residents to access the services they need.
People living outside of nursing homes have easier access to clinicians who can provide them with psychological therapy, but people living in nursing homes have a lot of trouble. One of the reasons for this is that there are very few psychologists who are trained to provide psychological treatments to older people living in nursing homes.
To help close the gap, he's designed a step-by-step educational guide for all aged care workers to help them identify and address any mental health issues when caring for residents. It includes resources to help them assess symptoms and make suicide risk assessments.
The project was about delivering and designing a set of resources that we think would be very helpful in terms of training psychologists and social workers and other allied health professionals to be competent and skilled in providing psychological treatments.
Janice Bull is the mental health coordinator at the Murray Primary Health Network in regional Victoria. She's trialling the new guide with her staff.
And they have found it particularly useful.
The number of older adults in aged care is expected to more than double by 2050. Professor Sue Neil Barr says the country's mental health system just isn't ready.
I'm hoping that universities catch on and they start providing training to their emerging professionals on how to deliver psychological strategies to older adults.
The federal government says it's trying to tackle the limited number of trained specialists in the workforce. A spokesperson for the Department of Health and Ageing says it's integrating specialist modules into its fee-free TAFE program to help train staff to better manage residents with mental health issues.
Kathleen O'Connor there. 1,346. That's how many Australian government bodies there are, according to the government's own register. That's 1,346 primary bodies, like the Department of Defence or Health, to the ATO or ABS, to the less well-known but nonetheless important National Operating Committee on Jet Fuel Assurance. And yet, new research indicates only about 45% of these government organs are clearly declaring their use of AI, despite a year-old policy requiring most federal agencies to publish AI transparency statements on their websites. Kimberly Wetherill is Professor of Law at the University of Sydney. I spoke to her earlier. Professor Wetherill, why is it important that government use of AI is transparent?
Well, it's impossible to hold governments accountable for their use of technology if they don't tell us what they're using. I mean, we've seen this problem before with things like the Robodebt Royal Commission. It's an important part of accountability, and of course, accountability is a really important part of building public trust in the use of these advanced technologies.
You suggest that this current transparency policy isn't working after looking at 224 government agencies. What did you find?
We went looking for the transparency statements that are meant to be required. What we found 29 relatively easily out of 224. That's not impressive. When we looked a bit deeper, we found another sort of 101 links to statements. So in essence, we found about half of what we were looking for, which was a bit disappointing, to be honest, because this is meant to be required.
What departments are we talking about that aren't following the letter of the law?
Oh, we're talking about government departments. We're talking about all the independent agencies. We're talking about regulators. These are all the ones that are supposed to be giving these statements, everything from, you know, the Federal Court to IP Australia to Services Australia. Now, I'm not naming any of those as having put up a statement or not put up a statement.
What do other nations do? What is best practice here?
It's interesting. I mean, best practice is to have a degree of transparency about what you're doing. So in the UK, they have a requirement to publish, you know, some information about the systems that they're using. You know, again, they haven't had perfect compliance, but they've got quite a lot of detail about a number of their systems. In the US, they've also, in the federal government, have a system requiring agencies to identify where they're using AI. And, I mean, in the federal system in the US, there's actually meant to be a requirement, I think, that if they aren't transparent, that they have to stop using the system. So, you know, increasingly we are seeing governments come out around the world and create AI registers. In the Commonwealth government at this stage, they haven't gone to that stage, to that kind of advanced level. What they've said is each individual agency should have a general statement about how it uses AI. But what that means is that if you want to have a sense of what's happening, you have to go to each individual agency and look for this statement and try to understand what it's doing. So it's, you know, from our perspective, it's not ideal. They could do better. You know, and I'm hoping over time they will start to do better.
Professor Kimberly Wetherill is from the University of Sydney. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
King Charles has been publicly heckled over the allegations surrounding his brother, Prince Andrew's connections to convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. The protest comes as the British Parliament considers a parliamentary motion to formally strip the Prince of his Duke of York title, which he only recently announced he would no longer use. Public pressure is building on Buckingham Palace to take further actions to denounce the royal family member after fresh claims were made by Virginia Roberts Dufresne in her posthumous memoir. Kimberly Price reports.
How long have you known about Andrew and Epstein?
While greeting the public outside Lichfield Cathedral in northwest England, a member of the crowd began shouting at King Charles.
Have you asked the police to cover up for Andrew's crime? What do you think should be allowed to debate the royals in the House of Commons?
The protest comes a week after Virginia Roberts Dufresne's posthumous memoir Nobody's Girl was released. In it, she writes that she was forced to have sex with the prince on three separate occasions, the first time when she was 17 years old and when he was 41. The prince has strenuously denied the allegations and says he never met Ms. Roberts Dufresne, but he settled a civil lawsuit for an undisclosed sum in 2022. Ms. Roberts Dufresne died earlier this year by suicide. Her brother, Sky Roberts, told 7:30 he's proud of her in his first Australian interview since the book was published.
So many times victims are silenced, and that's a repetitive pattern from abusers, is that they silence their victims, and I think she refused to stay silent.
Public outrage has been building over Buckingham Palace's handling of the sexual abuse allegations against Prince Andrew. The prince famously declared in a 2019 interview with the BBC that his relationship with convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein ended in 2010.
I had to show leadership and I had to go and see him and I had to tell him
That's it.
But earlier this month, an email exchange from 2011 between the Prince and Epstein was published by British newspapers. The Prince then announced he would give up his royal titles and honours. In the wake of the memoir's allegations, King Charles is reportedly considering evicting his brother from his home, Royal Lodge, on Windsor Castle's grounds.
This is the topic on everyone's lips over here at the moment, and it is just not going anywhere.
Bronte Coy is News Limited's royal correspondent.
The optics of having him in a 30-room palatial royal lodge is not good. People really want to see him forced to leave.
In what would be an unprecedented step, the British Parliament is considering a motion to formally strip the Prince of his Duke of York title. The Removal of Titles Bill has been introduced by independent MP Rachel Maskell.
We need to do something, and I think that's because polling in our country, 80% of people have said they want those titles removed once and for all.
The Metropolitan Police in London has confirmed it's investigating whether Prince Andrew tried to obtain information on Virginia Roberts Giuffre through his police protection. Andrew Loney is a historian and has written an unauthorised biography on the Prince. He believes the public pressure will force Buckingham Palace to take further action.
We're now moving towards much greater royal accountability and transparency, I hope, and I think there are now plans to strip him of his titles properly, to get him out of Royal Lodge, and I think we'll eventually see him going to exile.
Historian and author Andrew Lowney, ending that report by Kimberly Price. And if that story raised concerns for you or anyone you know, you can call Lifeline on 13 11 14. Driving in a car on country roads, it's normally kangaroos you need to watch out for, but you certainly won't see this one coming. A vet in South Australia says his windscreen was shattered by a falling meteorite in what could be a world-first instance of a strike on a moving car. Here's Angus Randall.
When you're driving on a country road at night, there are many hazards to keep an eye out for. Meteorites falling from the sky is not usually one of them.
It was like somebody fired a shotgun, just covered in glass.
Wyala vet Dr. Andrew Melville-Smith was driving his brand new Tesla in regional South Australia when something hit his car.
Totally out of the blue, there was this huge explosion. I mean, it was extremely violent. The next thing I remember is that I'm in the seat and I'm covered in glass. My wife's going, "The car's blown up."
The electric vehicle was in self-driving mode, so despite the chaos, it kept moving. But when it was safe to pull over, Dr. Melville-Smith found the windscreen hot to the touch and wondered what on earth, or perhaps off earth, had hit his car.
There's this crater in the windscreen where the windscreen's melted and sort of gone glug into the inside of the car and then re-solidified. And you can see the upward trajectory of whatever hit it. It must have been very, very hot.
He's so far been unable to locate the possible meteorite, but hopes there are fragments in the windscreen that will prove his story. The car will soon be in the hands of a team from the SA Museum, which under state law has the rights to all meteorites found on South Australian land. Geologist Dr. Kieran Meaney is from the SA Museum.
We get a lot of inquiries about meteorites because there are a lot of earthly rocks that do a very good impersonation of meteorites. So my first thought was, there's no way. And then I looked at the photos and read Andrew's description of what happened, and all of the earthly explanations sort of quickly faded away.
He says what separates this story from most others who suspect they found something from beyond the stars is the heat.
After it hit his windscreen, the car was full of smoke, and it looks like the glass had actually sort of melted and fused back together. I cannot come up with another explanation for what would have caused that.
The SA Museum team should get the windscreen next week and also plans to search the section of road where the car was hit. There have been several instances of meteorites hitting parked cars around the world, but no proven cases of a strike on a moving vehicle. Astronomer Jonty Horner is from the University of Southern Queensland. He says the heat could actually be proof it's not a meteorite.
You'd have an object hitting the Earth's atmosphere. As that pushes through the atmosphere, it feels really strong wind resistance. And so it slows down. And eventually when it's 20 or 30 kilometres up, if it survives that violent re-entry, it slows down to the speed that it's just moving at the same speed a rock would drop if you just dropped it out of a plane or a hot air balloon. And it's almost certainly going to be cold to the touch at that point, which I know is counterintuitive, But the reason is that these things have been held at the cold, cold temperatures of the depths of space for billions of years, and they've had a fleeting few seconds of being heated up as they pass through the atmosphere.
The SA Museum says there's no firm timeline on its investigation.
Good luck explaining that one to the insurance company. Angus Randall there, and that's all from the World Today team. Thanks for your company. I'm Andy Park.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Donald Trump is on the move, throwing his weight around in Asia. But will he have the upper hand when he sits down with the Chinese president, Xi Jinping, later this week? Today, Global Affairs editor Laura Tingle on why Trump won't be the most powerful man in the room. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.